loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, newly released internal documents reveal that for years, Facebook gave some of the world's largest tech companies more intrusive access to its users' private data than it had previously disclosed, effectively exempting those companies from privacy rules. In other words, Facebook sold your private data and then lied to you about it. Next, a Defense Department official confirmed President Trump's tweet this morning that he will order the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Syria. The president said that the only reason the U.S. was in Syria in the first place was to defeat ISIS. That's been accomplished, and so the troops will come home. Neither the president nor the Defense Department, however, gave a timeline for the withdrawal. Then, U.S. stock markets rose today in anticipation of the Federal Reserve Board's interest rate hike. We'll talk about that and the policy of trying to ward off inflation. And then police in Cleveland confirmed yesterday that an African-American man was denied the right to cash his paycheck because bank tellers thought he made too much money for the check to be good. When he demanded that they call his employer to confirm the check's authenticity, the tellers called 911, and the man was handcuffed and put into a police car. The police and bank officials later apologized. And finally, in a major policy reversal, the Trump administration is changing the way it reviews sponsors who want to care for migrant children in custody. The change could lead to thousands of children being released to family members already in the U.S. There are currently 14,300 unaccompanied children being held in government detention centers. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Facebook and personal security. Newly released internal documents reveal that for years, Facebook gave some of the world's biggest tech companies more intrusive access to its users' private data than it had previously disclosed, effectively exempting those companies from privacy rules. In other words, Facebook sold your private data and then lied to you about it. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Welcome back, Chris.
John, Brian, always good to be back. You'd think that we can go a couple days without a huge Facebook story, but apparently not.
Seriously, right? This is exactly what I was going to say.
And let's before we discuss whether or not this constitutes criminal conduct, let's talk about what the facts are. What did Facebook do?
Well, an investigation by three New York Times reporters who have been working on this for quite some time and have published other stories throughout the year shows from internal documents from 2017 that Facebook gave special access and even in some cases more access than they were requested to give to some major tech companies. We're talking about Amazon, Microsoft, Yahoo, some major banks, and others. What this access is access to your Facebook profile, your friends' Facebook information, and in some cases, even access to read and send on your behalf and delete Facebook messages.
What?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What is the reaction I had when I was drinking my coffee this morning and reading this story? It's, you know, even with everything we know about Facebook, it gets more unbelievable by the day, but this is very real. So some of these companies, for example, Apple and Netflix, say that they didn't even know that they had these permissions, while some others actually, you know, did use them and were aware of them. But the fact that Facebook, without telling you, can give companies access to all of this information about you is, as we always say, it's terrifying. And it's the reality of this privately owned company that has so much data. We should talk, you know, Mark Zuckerberg constantly says we don't sell data. And that's just kind of a legal workaround to the fact that what they sell is access to data.
Mm-hmm. I think Chris is not being sensitive to Mark Zuckerberg. Let's listen to some of the news that Mark has endured. Today, for instance, I'm looking at Business Insider. It's yesterday, actually. A disastrous year for Facebook has left a major dent in the wealth of its CEO and co-founder, Mark Zuckerberg. You know where I'm going now, John.
Oh, yes.
We have to be a little bit sensitive because he lost a lot of money.
Yes, the poor guy.
Zuckerberg began the year with about $75 billion, but according to Bloomberg's Billionaire Index, today he's worth only $56 billion. That's a $19 billion drop, Chris. I think you should be a little bit nicer to Mark.
Maybe I'll give him the same apology he constantly gives Congress when he testifies. I'm sorry. with all the meaning that's behind it.
He's only got $56 billion. I mean, why do they have to keep... I mean, isn't that enough? Do they have to lie to their 2.5 billion users about their privacy and then still sell it to Amazon and these other tech... I mean, when does it stop?
And why lie? Nobody reads those terms of service agreements anyway. So why don't they just bury it in there and say, oh, look, people, you agreed to this when you opened your account. It's in the terms of service. But so why lie about it?
Well, that's a good question. Why did they lie?
Why lie? Because they know. They know that their PR, their position right now in terms of public relations is awful. They know people are watching them. They know that every story that comes out like this is going to drive users away. And we are the product in terms of Facebook, right?
And I think it's also because, frankly, when they were doing this, this story goes back a couple of years. They didn't expect to be under this level of scrutiny.
Well, let's remember back to the documents that were just leaked by a British MP a week or two ago. And those say that in 2013, Facebook was very aware that a certain change to the permissions it got, asking for permission to read your text messages and call logs, would not be accepted by Facebook users, that they would be scared off by that. And so they found a way around asking you explicitly for that permission and still got it. That was about 4 years ago, and they still knew that it would not be well received by people using Facebook on their phones.
Mark Zuckerberg lost 15 to 16 billion. Again, everybody, a billion is 1,000 millions.
He stole that from the Winklevoss twins anyway.
There you go. So 16 billion, 1,600 millions he lost, and he still has a wealth of $56 billion. I mean, what do people do about this constant? I call it criminal conduct. You have people sign privacy agreements. They think their data is being protected. Actually, Facebook, going to the other biggest monopoly tech corporations, is selling them stuff so that they can do more pitched advertising, convincing people to buy things that they may not otherwise think they need. In other words, creating need. That's what they're doing. You have Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, and guys like Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, this is the billionaire class that's actually dominating the economy right now. It's a billionaire class. And, you know, when we were, when there was that story the other day, I think it was in the New York Times about what might undo the economy, point number one was a revolt against the billionaires, like what started to happen in France.
Right.
That could happen.
Absolutely could. I have to agree with that.
I would agree with that as well. And I think we have to, you know, keep in mind at the same time, this isn't just Facebook, right? This is Facebook partnering with the giants of Silicon Valley. It's Amazon, Google, Microsoft, all of these other giant companies. So again, not just Facebook. They're making these partnerships, and these other companies know what Facebook's reputation is. And in their internal documents, they say, like, we want access. And if you don't give us access to this certain thing, you know, we'll go out of business, or we can't offer this certain product or feature in our products. And Facebook is more than happy to oblige. We have to even go back to June of this year, where another New York Times story by these same three journalists actually reported that Facebook had made deals with 60 device makers to allow access to Facebook user data on those devices, whether or not you were even using the Facebook app on that phone. So this is a long time, and Facebook is certainly the face of it and should be. But this is all of Silicon Valley. This is all of the tech billionaires and related companies and the advertising industry that are complicit in this.
I want to read for our listeners the first two paragraphs from the New York Times article that we're talking about here. It's quite an extensive article. It goes on for pages and pages. It's in yesterday's edition, December 18th. It says here, for years, Facebook gave some of the world's largest technology companies more intrusive access to users' personal data than it has disclosed, effectively exempting those business partners from its usual privacy rules, according to internal records and interviews. The special arrangements are detailed in hundreds of pages of Facebook documents obtained by the New York Times. The records, generated in 2017 by the company's internal system for tracking partnerships, provide the most complete picture yet of the social network's data sharing practices. They also underscore how personal data has become the most prized commodity of the digital age, traded on a vast scale by some of the most powerful companies in Silicon Valley and beyond. So this isn't an accident. This isn't a one-time thing. This isn't something that's going to stop because the New York Times found out about it. This is what these social websites, these social media sites are all about. They're about collecting personal data and then monetizing it by selling it to those companies that need for you to be a consumer. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, just look at the next two sentences, actually. The exchange was intended to benefit everyone. Pushing for explosive growth, Facebook got more users, lifting its advertising revenue. Of course, in this article, when they talk about everyone, that means everyone involved in the business transaction except for the users. It doesn't benefit us in any way. It actually impacts us so very negatively to have our privacy violated like this.
Mark Zuckerberg bought that house in Palo Alto in 2016, but he was concerned about his privacy. Now, this is a very affluent area, obviously.
Oh, very, very
affluent. So what he did is he bought the four houses around his house. He paid $30 million, and then he destroyed all the houses. And he said this is in order to enhance his security. This is who we're talking about. This is what it's about. It's about these people are richer than the biggest, most fabulous sort of funds available to the kings and queens of antiquity or of medieval Europe. They are the new robber class, the new robber baron class. And each of us thinks of Facebook in a benign way. We think, oh, I want to talk to my friends. Or we think about Google. Oh, I want to find out I want to do a search to find out something. It's right at my fingertips. These companies are not benign.
Oh, no. They're not benign. And they really are the robber barons of our age. Look at Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison is the CEO of Cisco Systems. And the guy probably, for all I know, he probably earns his money. But he owns 75% of the island of Kauai, right? This is one of the major islands of the state of Hawaii. He owns 75% of the island. So every time a piece of property goes on sale there, no matter where it is or how much it costs, he buys it. And then knocks down the house.
He's playing Monopoly.
He's playing Monopoly. And eventually he's going to own every one of the properties on the board. And nobody's going to live there but Larry Ellison.
Well, just as God wanted it to be, Chris. I mean, obviously the system has some divine mandate. Or, on the other hand, we could understand it as basically a criminal enterprise.
Yep. We're going to have to leave it there, though, Chris. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A Defense Department official confirmed President Trump's tweet this morning that he will order the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Syria. The president said that the only reason the U.S. was in Syria was to defeat ISIS. That's been accomplished, and so the troops will come home. Neither the president nor the Defense Department, however, gave a timeline for the withdrawal. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. And we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik news analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here, John.
Happy to be here.
Rick, I've got to tell you, when I first saw this, I just assumed that there was some kind of a catch to it. And then people like Medea Benjamin at Code Pink began tweeting about it and Facebooking about it. And it looks like Donald Trump is serious, that he wants to bring the troops home. What do you make of this?
Well, I think, of course, that was a big part of his campaign to be president. And I think we should support it very strongly, just as we can see that the neoconservatives and the ultra hawks are opposing it and resisting it. Lindsey Graham calling it a colossal error and other people weighing in. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We'll see what happens in the coming weeks. But it's a positive indication.
You know, not to say that we're going to withdraw troops from Afghanistan or Iraq or any one of two dozen African countries, but I think this is a pretty big deal. And then Benjamin Netanyahu made a comment this afternoon in response to the announcement saying that Israel will do anything that it has to in order to protect itself and that he will engage in conversations about this with President Trump. Do you see the Israelis now getting more involved in Syria? Maybe more bombing in Syria than they've done in the recent past just because the U.S. isn't going to be there?
The Syrian military has S-300 anti-aircraft batteries now, and that is going to change the calculus in Israel. Those are much more effective than the S-200s that are decades old that Syria's been using up till now. So they've got much more effective anti-aircraft weaponry. There's a lot of vagaries here. We're going on a tweet from President Trump along with Sarah Huckabee had some, you know, they had a statement, and then there are reports based on statements from officials in the White House that have different slants to them. For example, the Washington Post is reporting that Trump is calling from the withdrawal from northeast Syria, not mentioning the U.S. bases in southern Syria. The New York Times is talking about a withdrawal from all of Syria within 30 days. Meanwhile, Lindsey Graham brought out his heavyweight persuasion by saying that if Trump did this, it would have devastating consequences and that it would be a huge Obama-like mistake. Of course, that's obviously intended to really get under Trump's skin. But, of course, Donald Trump, back in March of 2018, he said that we were going to be out of Syria very soon. What happened after that was within the next week, there was a supposed chemical weapons incident, and all the talk about withdrawing troops was forgotten. So what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks is going to be very interesting. It won't be surprising if there's some sensational incidents. And already, right out of the gates, we're seeing the neoconservatives, the ultra-hawks, and forces like Benjamin Netanyahu as well, who are going to be pushing back hard against this decision.
Yeah, Rick, I mean, let's back up and think about why the United States has decided to commit, you know, at least a couple thousand troops to occupying large parts of Syria in the first place. I mean, northeastern Syria, or Syria east of the Euphrates River, is strategically located. It's along the border with Iraq, where the United States, you know, of course, invaded in 2003, but has, you know, progressively seen its influence wane there. It's sparsely populated, but very rich in oil. These things haven't really changed. And I'm skeptical. I'm ultimately skeptical about this because, you know, it's so key to the U.S.'s strategy. And I think that Donald Trump, I mean, even Obama, who had much more of the loyalty of the state apparatus in the United States, one's unable to do so much as, you know, institute a nationwide ceasefire, or a countrywide ceasefire back in, I think it was 2015, because, you know, the Pentagon just took it upon themselves to bomb a Syrian government position. And that was it for the ceasefire. What's the likelihood of a maneuver like that happening?
Well, I think it's definitely possible. It's also possible that this is being strongly influenced by relations with Turkey, which, after all, is a NATO partner. There's heavy. Erdogan has a lot invested in attacks on the Kurds in northern Syria. And I think Trump and elements in the administration are very wary of escalating the conflict with Turkey. And then, as well, Turkey may have sweetened the deal with the crass business mentality of Trump. It's been reported there's $3.5 billion in new sales of Patriot, the advanced Patriot missile and other missile systems. So there was phone conversations in recent days between Trump and Erdogan, the Turkish president. That's probably playing a significant factor here. So it's meanwhile, we've got there's just such a lot of different elements and a lot of different forces at play here. The Israelis are in conflict at some levels with the Turks, of course. And then behind it all, we've got the U.S. mainstream media. And this is a good example of the disinformation and the deception, really. In the New York Times, they make the comment essentially comparing the U.S. bases in Syria to the Russian bases in Syria. Of course, you know, they both have some bases there. But the big difference, of course, is that Russia is there as an invited guest of the Syrian government, of the recognized, you know, Syrian government, whereas the U.S. is not. So they keep making that comparison, also the comparison between the U.S. presence and the presence of some Iranian troops. The Iranian presence has always been hugely exaggerated, but there are Iranian forces there, advisors in an advisory capacity. But, you know, once again, there's a fundamental difference between a country being in another country as invited guest and those who have just gone in there and established bases illegally, as the U.S. has.
When Turkey invaded Afrin, which is one of the cantons under the sort of Kurdish autonomous administration that was set up in northern Syria by the YPG, this group in Syria, the Kurdish group that Turkey considers to be a terrorist organization and a sister organization of the PKK, which operates inside of Turkey. When Turkey invaded Afrin, there was a momentary thaw in relations between the YPG and the Syrian government. There appeared to be some cooperation there. I believe the Syrian government sent not its regular army, but its militia that fight on the side of the government to Afrin to support the YPG. Do you think that in the event of another large-scale Turkish intervention, which this might be setting the stage for, you know, the announcement that the U.S. would be withdrawing troops, do you think that there could be an alliance formed between the YPG and the central government?
I do, definitely. Actually, from the beginning, there's been, you know, communications and there's been, you know, tacit understanding between Damascus and the YPG forces. At the end of the day, I believe they are going to work together. And that again raises the question, or that raises the issue of the remaining ISIS forces. And of course, you know, in contrast to the false claims of the U.S., of Washington, that they're the ones that have defeated ISIS, it's actually been the Syrian government that's played the biggest role and that's suffered by far the hugest losses against ISIS. But I think the solution to it really is for the YPG forces to work together and collaborate, and for they together can tackle the remaining ISIS forces that are in eastern Syria, which after all are there. They came in predominantly through Turkey. That channel, that corridor, has been, you know, significantly cut off. So they're in decline, they're in collapse, and all it takes is a concerted effort. So I do think there'll be an alliance there at the end of the day.
Rick, I want to ask you too about the notion of abandoning the Kurds, walking away from the Kurds. The Iraqi Kurds will tell any American who will listen that as close as we've been with them over the years, we walk away from them when it's no longer in our national interest to support Kurdish autonomy or a Kurdish republic or even Kurdish freedom in some cases. Do you think that this is just a different way of abandoning the Kurds and leaving them to the Turks?
The U.S., you know, has a pattern. When our government is invading and occupying another country, they always look for minority groups to promote, to work with, and to utilize for military purposes, whether it was the Hmong and the tribal groups in Southeast Asia, or the people from the Caribbean side of Nicaragua regarding the Contras. The U.S. has a long history of looking for and supplying, arming, and training and promoting groups. And they've done that with the Kurds in Syria. They've done it, of course, else in Iraq as well. But, you know, the Kurds are obviously very attuned to this. But one thing that's not as widely known as it should be is that many of the Kurds, in fact, the Kurdish leader, the Öcalan, has their plans are not for an independent Kurdistan. He's called for them to work together with progressive forces in the countries that they are part of, whether they're Kurds within Syria, Iraq, or Turkey. And that's what we saw happen in Turkey, where the Kurdish population worked with other progressive Turkish forces and made a huge, huge dent in Erdogan's, you know, government, and were on the cusp of removing Erdogan from power when it was his actions and the actions of the Turkish intelligence agency which escalated the violence and escalated the nationalist sentiment there, and then the attacks on Kurds in the south of Turkey, and then the threats against, and then ultimately the Turkish invasion of the northern border region of Syria. But I do think that at the end of the day, the Kurds are going to work with Damascus, and they'll work together to remove ISIS from eastern Syria.
That was the voice of Rick Sterling, who joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area, where he's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. U.S. stock markets rose today in anticipation of the Federal Reserve Board's interest rate hike. The board announced at 2 o'clock this afternoon that it would increase the prime interest rate by 0.25% to ward off inflation. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Steve, everybody expected this interest rate hike would be 0.25%. It was. It's supposed to keep inflation at bay, but we haven't had inflation really for decades. So was this really necessary?
Well, I think it's a sign of approaching recession, which the Federal Reserve is going to be probably the major culprit in causing.
Mm-hmm.
I do expect a boost to inflation in the immediate future, but I expect that to collapse pretty rapidly and to hopefully take the Federal Reserve with it.
Yeah, this is the fourth interest rate hike this year, and the president has been apoplectic, if you believe his tweets.
He's always apoplectic, isn't he?
That's right. But does he have a point? Is this a mistake?
Yes, he does have a point, and this is a mistake. But the entire management of the economy by the Federal Reserve is being a series of mistakes. So it's just maintaining their track record. There is going to be a boost to inflation. It is being caused by the economy being relative to recent times in a boom. But what is the inflation will disappear pretty rapidly, and people decide to start deleveraging again. And the Federal Reserve's rate hike is a massive encouragement to do that.
So what do you think we're looking at next? We're already talking about the 2020 presidential election. The economy is strong but weakening. Unemployment is still low. Now we have these incremental rate hikes. Are we looking at entering a slow recession? Is this something that we should be worried about for the 2020 elections?
Yes, I think we should. And it's the first downturn period of what I call the turning Japanese syndrome, because Japan went through exactly the same process back in 1990, allowed a private debt bubble to drive share prices and real estate prices through the roof. The economy hit a wall when people wouldn't continue borrowing anymore. It then plunged into a downturn. And then every time there appeared to be a recovery, the Japanese central bank would whack up rates or do something of that nature. And it would lead to people reducing their private debt once more. And when you reduce private debt, you reduce credit demand and the economy goes into a funk. So this is I think this is America's first Japanese funk.
If it is akin to what happened to Japan, we're talking about a long-term recession here or a long-term slowdown. So what do we do to prepare ourselves for it as consumers? And what can the government do to make a recession as short as possible?
Well, the deal as consumers, you've got to get out of debt. And when you get out of debt, you reduce credit demand and cause what you're trying to avoid. So in an individual sense, your best way to be safe when one of these strikes is to get out of debt. But the process of all of us getting out of debt is what actually causes the crisis in the first place. So that's the initial situation. In terms of the government, what it can do is two things. It can actually run a larger deficit, which America's got an unlimited capability to run with its the fact that it's the reserve currency of the planet as well as the world's largest economy. So Trump can spend more money and that'll reduce the impact of the downturn. Or the Fed can go back to quantitative easing again, which is another factor that now that it's doing quantitative tightening, that's another reason why the economy is slowing down. So there's government mechanisms to do it from both the Treasury and the central bank. But of course, what they both do is encourage the private sector to hang on to its excessive levels of private debt, which is the cause of the problem as well.
And so how does this impact consumers in the short term? You know, we always hear that the prime rate really isn't tied directly to things like credit card interest rates or car loan interest rates or mortgages. Is that really true? Or should we see money tightening and getting a little bit more expensive to borrow?
Well, money will get more expensive to borrow. The rate rises are quite substantial now. It's gone from zero. You know, it's quite the percentage rise is infinite. But it certainly will be affecting short-term borrowing rates, and it'll be affecting the funding costs of banks. So this will all feed through. And The corporate sector actually has got more debt now than it had during the financial crisis. So the corporate sector is likely to find its short-term cost of borrowing going up because since banks no longer lend to corporations for lines of credit, they've got to go through the commercial paper market, and that will get more expensive for firms. And that, again, is going to encourage them to have less credit-based demand.
Steve, I'm curious, too, why the markets did well today. Everybody seems to be in agreement that the economy is heading toward recession, even if it's not going to be a disastrous one like the last recession. So why would Wall Street and other indices around the world be excited about an interest rate hike?
Not because irrational exuberance is the modus operandi of financial markets. It's just the financial markets. A guy called Bob Hagen decades ago tried to find any relationship between actual news and the behavior of stock markets on that day and found bugger all. Relationship. It's an internal feedback system. So something will set them off and they'll go on that trend for a while and try to explain a day's movement in the stock market. Unless we get hit by a meteor, I think you're wasting your time trying to find a news-based reason as to why the market goes up or down.
We're speaking with Professor Steve Keen. He is the world's first crowdfunded economist. He's also the author of Debunking Economics, and you can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, the media here in the States talks a lot about quantitative easing, but nobody knows what that means. Can you explain it to us?
What it meant was that the Federal Reserve announced it was going to be, it does open market operations all the time with financial institutions buying and selling bonds to try to keep the interest rate in a target range. With quantitative easing, what they said they'd do is every month buy $85 billion worth net of bonds off the financial sector. So that meant if every year it was injecting $1 trillion worth of cash into the financial sector in return for taking $1 trillion worth of bonds onto its own books, and those are both government bonds and corporate bonds. So that's $1 trillion a year of money going into financial institutions, where the only thing they're legally allowed to do with that money is buy other financial products such as bonds or shares. With the Fed being on the buy side to the tune of $1 trillion a year on the bonds, there weren't many bonds to buy, so they bought shares. And that's what's really elevated the share market. And then a small amount of that money is trickled on from Wall Street onto Main Street because through bonuses for share market traders and through the salaries of staff and the equipment purchases they make, a bit of that money turns up in Main Street. So for every $1 trillion in, I reckon maybe Main Street got $1 billion out, got $100 billion out. And that's what's been a substantial support to the economy, of course, a great expense to the economy and mainly benefiting Wall Street rather than Main Street.
Steve, in our last couple of minutes, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about employment. We've got near record low unemployment here in the United States, which on the surface of things makes it look like the economy is very robust, very strong. If full employment is something like 4 or 5%, where at any given time, 4 or 5% of the workforce is going to be moving from one job to another, and we have unemployment of less than 4%, is that a real number, or have people just dropped out of the workforce because they can't find a decent job? And furthermore, is that number low because there are so many low-paying jobs out there?
Well, it's a combination of all those factors. And I regard the unemployment rate as a vaudeville act compared to the real world, because every time the unemployment rate rose, the statisticians would redefine it to make it fall again. The reliable one they can't actually fudge is what's called the civilian employment to population ratio. And that shows how much of the population has a job. Everybody who's alive is the denominator, so they can't fudge that. And the numerators have everybody that's employed by a factory or a business. Now, that number peaked at 65% back in 2000. It's currently running at 61%. So 3% of the population that had a job back in 64% actually, the population had a job back in 2000, doesn't have a job today. And the unemployment rate is recorded as being lower now than it was in 2000. So I think the economy has recovered a bit because it bottomed out at 58% of the population with a job, now at about 60.5, but it's nowhere near back to the pre-crisis levels, and it's certainly nowhere near back to the peak level, which occurred back in 2000.
We're speaking with Steve Keen from London. He's the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. Steve, in our last 45 seconds, should we be looking at more interest rate hikes as we head into the new year? A quarter is a short period of time. What do you think is going to happen with the Fed?
I think they're likely to put the rates up one or two more times before it becomes obvious the economy is falling back into another recession again, and they'll be forced to reverse direction.
Well, that was the voice of Steve Keen. Steve is the author, as I said, of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Police in Cleveland confirmed yesterday that an African-American man was denied the right to cash his paycheck because bank tellers thought he made too much money for the check to be good. When he demanded that they call his employer to confirm the check's authenticity, the tellers instead called 911 and the man was handcuffed and put into a police car. The police and bank officials later apologized to him. We're joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. He's an activist and organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. We're also joined by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Kofi, let's start with you. When I read this article yesterday for the first time, I actually didn't believe it. I had to Google it just to see if anybody else was covering it because it was so outrageous. I couldn't believe something like this could happen. So here's this poor guy, Paul McCowns. He went into the Huntington Bank. It's a place called Brooklyn Township. It's a suburb of Cleveland. And he went to cash his first paycheck from a job with an electric company. So he goes in there and the paycheck was just for a little bit more than $1,000. We're not talking about massive major amounts of money here. And the tellers asked him for two forms of ID, which he provided. And then they asked him for a fingerprint, which he also provided. He said that the bank employees started looking at a computer screen and then looking at each other. They were questioning the transaction. And then ultimately they refused to cash the check. So he said, why don't you call my employer? He'll tell you that it's a legitimate check. They tried multiple times, he says, to call the employer who never picked up. And instead, without saying anything to McCowns, as he left the bank, these two bank tellers called 911. A police squad car pulled up in front of his truck before he could drive away. They take him out of his car, they cuff him, and they put him in the police cruiser. All the time with him saying, look, I'm just trying to cash my paycheck. Finally, the cops were able to get in touch with the employer, and the employer said, yeah, he's worked for me for 3 weeks, and that's his paycheck. In fact, the employer said, quote, yes, he works for me. He just started, and yes, my payroll company does pay him that much. He was finally released. The cops apologized, and then the bank issued this sort of half-hearted apology, saying, we sincerely apologize to Mr. McCowns for this very unfortunate event. We accept responsibility for contacting the police as well as our own interactions with Mr. McCowns. Anyone who walks into a Huntington branch should feel welcomed. But the bank has seen 11 cases of fraud in recent months, and the tellers were hyper-vigilant as a result. So tell us, is this an anomaly, or is this just a part of being Black in 2018, 2019 America?
Well, we know that's a rhetorical question, right?
I was trying not to laugh as I said it.
Right? Unfortunately, we have countless examples of from, you know, the Starbucks incident to Barbecue Becky to so many videos that have gone viral of white people weaponizing 911 against Black people. And we know when you call and stick to the police on Black people, that we usually end up dead in those situations. So it's definitely something that is not an anomaly. It's structural. I always reference Khalil Muhammad. He's going to have to start sending me a stipend for it. But basically, he has a book called The Condemnation of Blackness, where he analyzes over 100 years of propaganda against Black people, criminalizing them and putting out this constant narrative that we are inherently violent, we are inherently criminal. And all the policies from, you know, the drug war to predating that has always been about criminalizing us and putting, you know, that narrative out. So this is another situation where the police could have killed this man. I mean, we're talking about a police department that, you know, allowed the killer of Tamir Rice to continue to work for their office. So we're just thankful that he came out of this situation alive. But this also makes me think about the joke that Dave Chappelle once told about, you know, him getting arrested in his own home and, like, police looking at the pictures of him in his own house and saying, look, this N-word, you know, put up pictures of himself after breaking in, you know. And then the reality of that happened with, famously, with Henry Louis Gates Jr., who was arrested while trying to go into his own home. And Barack Obama had an opportunity to really, you know, have those conversations around police accountability and structural racism inherent within the police department. But instead sat down with Henry Gates Jr. and the arresting officer and had a beer with both of them and made it seem as if it was an interpersonal misunderstanding and apologized for it as if it wasn't a structural thing. Then fast forward later on, you know, Trayvon Martin would be killed, and he claimed that Trayvon Martin could have been his son, but, you know, didn't take any real proactive steps towards, you know, police accountability. So the state and corporations kind of working together to, again, constantly, you know, exploit our labor, criminalize us, and then justify our death, you know, because, you know, we're scary. White people clutch your purses when black people are around, kind of, you know, situation. Until that power dynamic changes, we're going to continue to be put in these vulnerable positions where we're just doing our everyday life routines and we're not safe.
You know, of course, racist incidents like these happen in all sorts of different institutions. But I mean, it just adds an extra something that this was at a bank, right? Because, I mean, the banks is sort of like writ large as an institution. I mean, they have a very deep history of discriminating against African-Americans, right? I mean, if it's in the housing market and small business loans, things like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, from, like you said, from redlining to denying loans or having exuberant interest rates, credit ratings, all of those things are definitely structural violence. But again, to see it on an interpersonal, you know, level that, you know, this person posed a threat because their blackness had been weaponized. And, I, you know, first of all, I didn't even know that was a response to fraudulent checks, that it was a, you know, on the scene kind of police, you know, relationship with the banking institution. So, you know, that in itself needs to be questioned, right? Like, you know, what is the relationship between the state and the business and, you know, and then add to it the weaponizing of blackness and going after, you know, black people that are just trying to live their lives.
You know, the role of the police is so crucial here, right? Because, you know, you have the individual prejudice of the tellers. And, you know, the stories I've read haven't specified the race of the bank employees, but I mean, it's in a suburb. If it's like most suburbs in the country, these were white employees, right? And then you have, you know, the police being mobilized to defend, you know, the privileged position of people, but also, you know, the property of the bank, right? You know, the fact that the bank might be losing money was something to that the police immediately sprang into action to stop. But for instance, you know, in the 2008 economic crisis, black people in particular were targeted for these predatory loans by the big banks. You know, there was, you know, enormous foreclosures. Many of the loans were given out on a fraudulent basis by the banks. I don't think the police are going to be speeding down the street to arrest any of these executives, right?
Exactly. Exactly. The famous director out of Flint, Michigan.
Oh, Michael Moore.
Thank you. I know he had did a parody on that with, like, police breaking into corporate offices and arresting CEOs for those very things, right? But that's it. It's just a parody. The reality is, you know, because of capitalism, because of racism, you know, poor marginalized folks are going to be criminalized and they're going to be penalized in a very punitive fashion for, you know, not having that leverage power, you know, to go against these structures of inequality. And those were just prime examples you gave from an institutional level down to an individual level on how banks have played an active role in repressing us and contributing to that. You're on point with that.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that's actually not rhetorical. And I know that we have to talk about baby steps, but what can Americans do to end up at a place where this kind of thing doesn't happen anymore?
I think it boils down to power and perception. And as long as the predominant narrative on, constantly being shown on the nightly news day in and day out is beware of the boogeyman, and the boogeyman is a black person, that's going to fuel the fire, the structural racism that continues to punish us. But also, again, this boils down to inequity and power. As long as we live in a country that's capitalist, that's immersed in these structural inequalities, then I don't think we flip that on its head. So unless we're talking about real moves towards socialism or whatever that may be, but on a massive scale, reparations and really getting to the balance of real equitable kind of solution. Until we have those conversations and have policy written that reflects that, not much is going to change. It's not about attitudes. It's not about how Starbucks, showed a video for an hour after, they had it themselves on the back of shutting down their businesses for a day to show the video on sensitivity of racism and implicit biases and all these kind of other very superficial remedies towards the structural and overall inequality. That's my opinion. Until we get to those root causes, yeah.
That was the voice of Kofi Adamola, who joined us from Chicago. He's an activist and organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's one of the producers of the show and a Sputnik News analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. In a major policy reversal, the Trump administration is changing the way it reviews sponsors who want to care for migrant children in custody. The change could lead to thousands of children being released to family members already in the U.S. There are currently 14,300 unaccompanied children being held in government detention centers. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Welcome back, Isabel.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me again.
Isabel, this seems on the surface of things to be good news, is it?
Well, yes. I mean, when you throw 100 people out in the ocean and you throw out 5, 10, life rafts, are we happy? Yes. This is maybe a bit more if this administration and whoever processes these individuals and these applications, if they process them with good faith and reasonable criteria without ulterior motives to see if their parents or grandparents or uncles or brothers and sisters can be subject to ICE detention. That is what keeps people from being able to show up for these thousands and thousands of children. I'm a member here of Free the Children Coalition, and we have members who have been there, and we sent a delegation to go and just observe. You need to know that this place was located purposely right at the edge of the border, bordering another little town that has been pretty much overrun by cartels, and it's isolated. Our members were able to look at it on the international bridge and take photographs and actually hear kids, yelling. And at one point they thought they heard open the doors, and then there was, laughter, screaming, that kind of thing. But when you're housing 2,000 children of these age groups, I mean, how in the world are you going to parent and school and farm and keep safe, socialize and all of it? I mean, this is horrendous that in our country we have child prisons because those children are not free to leave. If you're not free to leave, you're detained. It is a prison, regardless of what anybody argues. And so I am hoping that this leads to a beginning of a relook at all of our policies here, especially regarding our children. Detention as a whole should be a last resort for anything, and that is the beginning to challenge ourselves, our minds. I mean, just today there was a Senate bill that was signed to do a little bit in criminal reform. It's but a drop. And in this arena, it's where it's grown, the detention of immigrants and their families.
Isabel, with so many children being held in custody, 14,300 children, let's say 5%, 10%, whatever it is, are released to the custody of family members, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, whoever it happens to be now with this policy change. That still leaves thousands upon thousands of children being held in these detention centers. A lot of these look like prison camps. They're surrounded by fences with barbed wire. You have children living in tents in many cases, or structures that were put up quickly just to house people along the border. We're not talking about any changes in the kinds of facilities, the comfort level, the amenities provided to these children. We're just talking about the notion that a handful of them may be released, right?
That's correct. That is correct. I mean, while we welcome this move because children need to be free, it only represents a tip of what is going on. These children, I don't care what their situation is, that they're unaccompanied, they do not deserve to be in prison camp conditions, and that is what we're facing here. There are better ways to deal with the situation, and we are not attempting those solutions. You know, the fact of the matter that the ACLU found that the government had, for instance, the addresses and phone numbers and how to locate the family members, and they didn't give them over. I mean, that gives us a lot of pause about what is going to happen here. So, yes, first we need to protect what they said they were going to do. If this turns out to be a setup so that people are detained, the families are detained, I mean, we have to be really alert to that. And sometimes it happens in isolation. But secondly, we need to continue releasing these children. It is a costly venture the way we have it done. And we can do a better job of trying to provide families for these children instead of keeping them in custody at a huge cost to the public. People don't know. And these nonprofits that are their CEOs are making astronomical incomes, salaries at the end of the year. This is an outrage. Really, it is torture. There's no way around it. The death of a 7-year-old little girl here at the border after being in custody for 8 hours, I mean, should tell us something about how we are supposed to treat each other.
Yeah. And tell me, Isabel, with Democrats taking over control of the House, are we going to see any changes in immigrant detention policy? Are we going to see any changes in the way especially children are treated?
We feel better. I mean, there is a new crop, and within the new crop of Congress people, I believe there are some individuals that have more reason, because you have to admit, the Congress and the Senate has not properly represented our communities. I mean, ICE has become a really rogue agency for the private contractors, and that's who they work for in large measure. So it's time that the Democrats really look at the issue of comprehensive immigration reform. And comprehensive doesn't mean beefing up the border. Comprehensive means looking at why people are coming from these countries and the role that the United States has played in this migration to our country. That's the solution there. In the meantime, we need to exercise what I heard a Latin American leader say, that we need to show radical hospitality. In the meantime, that is far cheaper than the gross and brutal militarization that has been faced by not only the people trying to come in, whether in a caravan or individually, as well as our community members that live along the border. Jose Antonio Elena was living on the border on the Mexican side, and he was shot and killed. And so we all have to understand that this implicates all of our rights. The detention of children shows that we have reached a really low point in our history.
Isabel, what would comprehensive immigration reform look like with the parties splitting the two houses of Congress and a Republican president? And is such a thing possible with Donald Trump?
Well, if you're asking me what is possible between the current makeup of the Senate and the House and our president, I mean, that's a really tough one because I believe that we have to have reason prevail in this country. In other words, you know, let's get at the very first base of comprehensive, and that is having a real discussion on immigration in this country, looking at the historical impact as well as what currently is happening. I mean, I see and read the mainstream media all the time, and the only thing that is mentioned is that people are fleeing violence and poverty, without any mention about why that happened. I mean, it is unraveled. And in Honduras in 1963, we supported a military takeover, and we have continued to support that, to support those people that are repressing the very individuals that are being forced to flee, lying to the people, being hypocrites that we have a globalized world while we're putting deadly traps for all the human beings, except maybe the 1 or 2% that, of course, are guaranteed safety. And those travels across the world.
Well, I guess now it's 17, almost 18 years ago, President George W. Bush was negotiating with the government of Mexico to allow guest workers in the United States on a new class of visa that would allow immigrants to come to the U.S. to work for a certain period of time, whatever it was, 6 months, 9 months, 10 months, 12, I don't remember, and then pay taxes and then go back to their country, only to return then in the next, whatever it was, growing season. It was mostly for migrant farm workers. Both sides agreed to this, and it ended up just sort of imploding because of the 9/11 attacks. Do you see something like that being resurrected that would sort of relieve the pressure that we're seeing on the border and allow both sides to declare victory?
I don't know. You know, I really can't give an answer about that. What I have to express is that there has to be some level of demilitarization at the border, some acknowledgement of the reality. And the reality is that we've always had millions of undocumented immigrants because our economy has depended on it, right? We immigrants follow the capitalist rules of supply and demand. When labor is needed, we have flooded the country because of labor needs. Are we going to go then into a guest worker program? I don't believe that's the answer. Why are we not accepting people as just people? Why do we continue in a pattern of like, oh, we want you, like we're going to rent you out like widgets. We're going to rent you out like a machine for 6 months, and you better not complain while you're here. And then when you're done, we're going to dispose of you, and you better go back to your country. To what? To where? And what have we done to make up for the damage that we've done to those countries so that people can return and not feel forced to migrate into our country?
That was the voice of Isabel Garcia. She joined us from Tucson, Arizona. Isabel is the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.